So we're on the second of our pre-Pesach sessions, and as we normally do, we'll begin by devoting some time to a matter of halacha or minhag that relates to Pesach. And the topic that I wanted to speak about this evening is the Seder plate, known as the Ka'ara. No Seder table is complete without one. And for us, currently, the Seder plate is the centerpiece of the Seder table. Currently, that is to say, in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, the Korban Pesach is the centerpiece. But we have the Ka'ara. Where does the Seder plate come from? And what are its parameters, elements, and guidelines? Actually, there is no reference to a Seder plate in Chazal. That is to say, the Mishnah and the Gemara, they don't speak about a Ka'ara, a Seder plate. They do speak about all of the entities that make it onto the Seder plate. And that is actually from the Mishnah. The Mishnah in the final chapter of Maseches Psachim tells us what it is that there should be in front of the person on Seder night. Matzos, of course. Maror and Charoses. And then another vegetable for karpas. And finally, what the Mishnah calls shnei tavshilin, two cooked dishes. And those two cooked dishes are a zecher, are a commemoration of the two korbanos that would typically be brought on the 14th of Nisan, the Korban Pesach, of course, and also the accompanying Korban Chagiga, which was a korban brought to ensure that the Korban Pesach would be eaten not when a person is ravenously hungry, but towards the end, so it could be supplemented by the second korban. And these are the two tavshilin. One is a zecher for the Korban Pesach, one is a zecher for the Korban Chagiga of the 14th. The Mishnah doesn't specify what these two cooked dishes should be. The minhag typically is to have one as a zroa, what we call the zroa, which is either a wing or a neck or a shank bone or whatever it is, and the second is an egg. But those are the two tavshilin. Interestingly, and it doesn't relate to us this year, but some people are of the opinion, some authorities, that in a year, such as last year in fact, where Erev Pesach falls on Shabbos, there should not be two tavshilin on the Seder plate. Because the second one, the egg, which is a zecher for the Korban Chagiga is not brought if the 14th falls on Shabbos. So people who track things in real time, year by year, some are of the opinion that in a year such as last year, there would not be an egg on the Seder plate, just the one zroa for the Korban Pesach. I think the widespread minhag is to have the egg on the Seder plate for all years. It's a general type of zecher. And that is the Mishnah. But no mention of a Seder plate. The first time we hear about Seder plates, the Ka'ara, is more in the time of the Rishonim. And effectively they say that everything that the Mishnah mentioned, all of those entities, should be housed together by a single central plate that we call the Seder plate. And everyone more or less agrees as to what should be on the plate, everything we mentioned in the Mishnah. I will mention, yes indeed, I will mention that there is one of the Rishonim, and when I tell you what he says, you might share my surprise that certain people have not picked up on this and made something of it. And this is the Sefer Shibboleth HaLeket. Shibboleth HaLeket, one of the, I think, lesser quoted Rishonim, Rabbeinu Tzidkiah HaRofe was his name. And the Gemara informs us that in order to keep the attention of the children, to make sure that they're awake and attuned and focused and motivated, is to distribute throughout the course of the Seder certain treats, what's called kalayos ve'egozim, which in those days were about as elaborate as treats for children could be, nuts and garinim and so on and so forth. And that actually continues to be true, that treats should be distributed for a good question asked, a good answer offered. That really is from the time of the Gemara. lo and behold, according to the Shibboleth HaLeket, the Seder plate should have room on it for the treats for the children. That's quite amazing. I can imagine a lot of enterprise could be made out of that opinion, but somehow it hasn't become the mainstream opinion, but certainly worthwhile mentioning. But let's get back to the mainstream opinions, which is the items in the Mishnah, they are the ones on the Seder plate. And now the question is there any insistence or any specific guidelines or parameters in terms of how things should be, these things should be arranged on the Seder plate? Can one put them in any arrangement that they want? It happens to be that according to the Ramah, and this is mentioned in Shulchan Aruch, in the Ramah, according to the Ramah, there is insistence. One should be particular. And the guiding principle which should inform the order and arrangement of the items on the Seder plate is a general principle when it comes to mitzvahs, which is called Ein Ma'avirin Al HaMitzvahs. One does not, pardon the expression, but it is the correct expression, one does not pass over the opportunity to perform a mitzvah. Which means that if there's a mitzvah at hand, you shouldn't reach past it for another mitzvah. And therefore, on Seder night, items should be arranged so that whatever you need first should be closest to you. And therefore, particularly or specifically, the items closest to the person on the Seder plate should be the karpas and the salt water. Actually, according to the Ramah, karpas is dipped either in vinegar or in salt water. I think we typically use salt water, but Ramah mentions both. So the thing that is closest to you, the two closest items, are the ones you'll use earliest, karpas and the salt water. Behind them, as far as the person is concerned, behind them are the matzahs, the three matzahs. Behind the matzahs are the maror and the charoses, because we eat matzah before we eat maror. And then behind all of that are the two tavshilin, or the zroa and the egg. And thus everything is arranged just as it should be. You never need to reach past anything in order to do the mitzvah of that time. That is what the Seder plate looks like according to the Ramah. Interestingly, I came across it's quite a fascinating question asked by Reb Shlomo Zalman Orbach. Because here we are saying that when it comes to Seder night, we're guided by the general principle of Ein Ma'avirin Ala Mitzvahs. You don't reach past something to do another mitzvah. Says Reb Shlomo Zalman, this is a general principle. Do we ever act at our su'udas based on this principle? And specifically what he means to ask is, every Friday night and every Shabbos morning, you have two mitzvahs at hand, Kiddush and Hamotzi. And they're both mitzvahs. And you do Kiddush first. Has anyone ever said that the wine and such forth that's used for the Kiddush should be closer to the one making Kiddush than the Chalas? I don't think we've ever heard such a thing. I think typically the Chalas could be right in front of him, and he might reach past them for the wine or the grape juice or whatever it is. Why do we never pay attention, seemingly, to this principle of not reaching past a mitzvah? You reach over the challah to get the wine. It's an interesting question. One could even ask, Manishtana, Alayla Hazeh, Mikol Alaylos. It's the only night that we seem to be particular about this. And Rav Shlomo Zalman gave a classic answer, and that is, when it comes to Kiddush and Hamotzi, you cannot eat from the Hamotzi before making Kiddush. And therefore, before you've made Kiddush, Hamotzi is not a mitzvah for you. It's actually not allowed to the person. And therefore, when you reach past, if you should reach past the challah to get the wine, you're not reaching past a mitzvah. It doesn't become a mitzvah until you made Kiddush. So that is why he says there is no insistence throughout the course of the year to have the wine on which you'll make Kiddush first closer to you than the challahs that you'll use second. Either way, this is the Seder plate according to the Ramah. A second opinion is the Arizal. And according to the Arizal, the items, and he lists six items on the Seder plate, they're basically arranged in two triangles. That is to say, you have the Zroa and Beitza up here, and then in the middle, Maror, and then Karpas and Haroses, and then another portion of Maror, two triangles. The reason, we will not be surprised to hear, is Alpi Kabbalah. Meaning these represent the spherous emanations on the right and the left and the middle and again. And that is the opinion of the Arizal. What's very interesting is we find something with regards to the Seder plate that I don't think is so common. Namely, the widespread minhag amongst all Jews, Sephardi and Ashkenazi, is to use the Arizal's Seder plate. And this is a phenomenon which has already been noted by great Ashkenazi poskim, the Chaye Adam of Danzig, Germany, and the Aruch HaShulchan, two outstanding mainstream Ashkenazi poskim, both say that as much as the Ramah gives his prescription for the Seder plate, but the minhag has become like the Arizal. And indeed it is so. I'm not aware of that many people, or anyone in fact, who has a Seder plate like the Ramah. I don't actually know if there is a Seder plate like the Ramah. I think the way that we've described it, it would take out half the table, because you have a certain items in front of the matzah, certain behind them. In the years before I actually had a Seder plate, I arranged things like the Ramah. But when my wife wanted to buy me a Seder plate, I requested, get a Ramah Seder plate, and that's when I discovered there's actually no such thing. And indeed, normally, it's fair to say, as a rule, the world of halacha is halacha, and Kabbalah is Kabbalah, and never the twain shall meet. And people who act halachically and not necessarily with Kabbalah, you don't see many Kabbalah practices. And yet, somehow the Seder plate of the Arizal took over, and can be found, I think, in most, if not all, Jewish homes. Another interesting thing to point out, the difference between the two Seder plate arrangements as we've seen them so far, namely, again, the Ramah and the Arizal, is not only in terms of how the items are arranged, but where do the matzahs feature in all of this? In other words, according to the Ramah, the matzahs are in the middle of these items. There's certain things before them, karpas and salt water, certain things behind them, maror haroses, Zroa and Beitza. But the matzahs in the middle. According to the Arizal, the matzahs are underneath. Meaning you have your three matzahs and then you place the Seder items on top of them. And in fact, according to the Arizal, the three matzahs are part of the Kabbalistic arrangement that comes. And therefore, strictly speaking, those who follow the opinion of the Arizal should have the matzahs underneath. Practically, it's not so straightforward, because if you have a Seder plate of significant size or weight, more particularly, so your matzahs might be in jeopardy if you place all of that on top of the matzahs. And therefore, there are many people, even if they follow the arrangement of the Arizal, they won't put it on top of the matzahs, unless you have one of those three-dimensional multi-story Seder plates, in which case you can have the matzahs underneath. According to the Arizal, you should. The only other custom with regards to the Seder plate is the Vilna Gaon. I say the only other. The third custom is the Vilna Gaon. And again, he has matzahs in the middle, certain things before it, certain things after it. I've never seen anyone do a Vilna Gaon Seder plate. I assume people that follow the Vilna Gaon as a matter of general policy follow him also in this matter. I don't see why not. But either way, these are some of the general comments and highlights with regards to something that every Jewish table has on its Seder, the Seder table, which is the Seder plate, just to get a sense of where it comes from and the forces at play in terms of what is on it and where they are. So having discussed, again, like we say, an element of halacha and minhag, let us now proceed to the Haggadah itself. And I'll say by way of preference to the discussion that upon which we are about to embark, I think it's fair to say that commentaries on the Haggadah come in two forms. Certain commentaries are bit by bit, part by part. Whatever paragraph is in front of them, that is what they comment on, without reference to what came before or after. It is an itemized commentary, like Rashi's commentary on the Torah, one could say. Osek b'mitzvah, potter mena mitzvah. They're involved in this paragraph, and that is the focus of their attention, and then they move on to the next paragraph. There are, however, a number of classic commentaries on the Haggadah who demonstrate and seek to demonstrate, and this is the backbone of their commentary, how there's a certain progression of themes that moves certainly throughout Maggid. And therefore they lay down the bedrock principles and then show how each ensuing paragraph develops that theme. And such a commentary is the one that we are about to take. It is the commentary of the Netziv on the Haggadah. And let us begin ourselves by asking a number of questions. I think when we get into what you could call the second half of Maggid, there are certain things we take for granted. Certainly, whatever is in the Haggadah, we say, we don't ask questions. All the more reason to invest some thought and understanding in these things before the event. As we know, the guiding vector of Seder night is given to us in the Mishnah, in Psachim, Maschilin Bignus Umesaimim B'Shevach. We begin with a negative and end with a positive. Why begin with a negative? Why not just think positive? Just start with be positive all night long? Because if we wish to appreciate the positive, it is human nature that appreciation is a function of contrasts. If you have everything and you have no notion of having less than everything, you don't appreciate anything. And therefore, because Seder night is a night of thanksgiving and a night of appreciation for all that Hashem did for us, you got to remember how things were from the outset. The contrast is what breeds the appreciation. So we maschilim bignus, we start with a negative and end with a positive. And the million-dollar question is, what is the negative and what is the positive? What do we mean when we say we start with the gnus, the negative? And what do we mean when we say mesayimim b'shevach, we end with the positive? And on this matter, there is a classic dispute between the two sages of the Talmud, Rav and Shmuel. According to Shmuel, the negative and positive are Avadim Hayinu, we were slaves in Egypt, Vayotziyenu, and Hashem took us out. There's your negative, there's your positive. According to Rav, however, it's a little bit broader than that. The negative with which we start, according to Rav, is the section Mitchila Ovdei Avodah Zarah Hayu Avoseinu. Initially, our ancestors were idol worshippers, and then the positive on the other side is Va'achshav Kervanu Hamakom La'avodoso. And now Hashem has taken us out of, has drawn us close to his service. That's quite a machlokas. I mean, that's a very different, those are two different stories. They're not contradictory to each other, but they're not the same. And what lies behind this machlokas, this bedrock machlokas, Rav and Shmuel? What's the negative and what's the positive? Interestingly, we on Seder night have the luxury of not having to choose between those two opinions. We do both. We say Avadim Hayinu. We say Mitchila Ovdei Avodah Zarah Hayu Avoseinu.
So wait, the night is young, and we have time for both, and we say both.
Although interestingly, we start with the later. In other words, Mitchila Ovdei Avodah Zarah, our ancestors were originally idol worshippers. That goes all the way back to Terach, before Avram came on the scene. So it's interesting that even as we seek to fulfill both opinions, we give the historically later answer first. And then a few paragraphs in, we go back for the historically earlier answer. What is behind that? We have our Haggadah handy, and of course we're familiar from our Seders with these quotations. But if we take a close look at the section, if we open up, it's just after the four sons, and then Yochel Mirosh Chodesh, we say, Mitchila Ovdi Avodah Zarah Hayu Avoseinu. Originally, our ancestors were idol worshippers. Va'achshav Kervon Hamokom La'avodoso. Now Hashem has brought us close to His service. As we know, on Seder night, when we say things, we then quote verses to back them up, to provide basis for that. And here, we quote two verses from Sefer Yehoshua. Shina Emar, Vayomer Yehoshua El Kol Ha'am. Yehoshua says to the people, Kol Amar Hashem Elokei Yisrael, Be'ever HaNahar Yashvu Avoseichem Ba'olam, Me'olam. From antiquity, your ancestors were on the other side of the river, Terach Avi Avram Vavi Nachor, Terach Father Avram and Nachor, Vayavdu Elohim Achirim. And they served idols. Terach and perhaps others. And then we quote a second pasuk. Vayikach es avichem es Avraham me'eiver hanahar. I took your forefather Avram from over the river, va'olechoso b'kol Eretz Kanan. I let him pass through and led him through Eretz Kanan, va'arbe asaro. I increased his descendants, va'etin lo es Yitzhak, I gave him Yitzhak, va'etin le Yitzhak es Yaakov es Esav, I gave Yitzhak Yaakov and Esav. Yishmael is curiously absent from this pasuk. Va'etin le Esav es Har Seir le Reshes Oso, I gave Esav Mount Seir to inherit, v'Yaakov uvanav yardu Mitzrayim. Yaakov and his sons came down to Mitzrayim. That is the section of Mitchila Ovdei Avodah Zarah. And if we watch carefully, we'll note that the two verses that we quote only seem to back up the first thing that we said. We have insufficient backup verses because we said two things. Firstly, we said our ancestors were initially idol worshippers. Then we said, but subsequently, Hashem brought us close to His service. So now we're looking to our verses. Let's see it in the sources. But the sources only talk about the first thing. Originally, they were idol worshippers. It goes on and on and on and on. But it doesn't get to the point where Hashem brought us close to His service, which is, of course, a reference to the giving of the Torah. Why not have a verse to back up that as well? A study of the Haggadah necessarily requires our attention for questions like this. We can't coast through and we can't take things for granted or gloss over things. And that is the question. An almost converse situation we find in the next paragraph, where it says, Baruch Shoma Haftachoso LeYisrael, we thank Hashem for keeping His promise to Yisrael, that is to take us out of Egypt. And to that, we quote the verse in Parshas Lech Lecha, two verses, Vayomer la'Avram, Yodoa Teda, Hashem says to Avram, this is at the Bris Ben HaBesorim, the covenant between the pieces. Hashem says to Avram, you shall know, Ki Geri Yezarecha Be'eretz Lelahem, your descendants will be strangers in a land which is not theirs, Va'avodum, Ve'inu Osam, they'll enslave them, they'll persecute them. Then, Abraham Yoshana, 400 years. And then, V'gamis Hagoya She Avodu Don Anochi, but then I will judge the and punish the nation that they served, V'achirichen Yetzu B'chush Gadol, and then they will leave B'chush Gadol. Again, if we look carefully, we will see that we have the opposite problem that we had in the first paragraph. Namely, we thank Hashem for keeping His promise. But the part of the promise that we're thanking Him for is only the second half of the Bris Ben HaBesorim, where it says the people who enslaved us will be judged and will leave Beruchosh Gadol. But here we seem to overquote because we start the promise of the Bris Ben HaBesorim from the very beginning. Your descendants will be strangers in a land which isn't theirs. Why not just cut to the end? And the Haggadah is capable of quoting half psukim. It knows what it wants. It quotes in a surgical manner. So if we thank Hashem for keeping the promise of taking us out, so quote the part of the pasuk that has Him taking us out. Or the promises to take us out. Not the whole thing from the very beginning. And finally, What comes next? Well, after Vihisha Amdu, then we say, Tseu Lamat. This will be our final quotation, and then all of our raw materials will be in front of us. Tseu Lamat, go out and learn. Ma bikesh lovan ha'arami lasos li Yaakov Avinu. Go out and see, learn what Yaakov tried to do to Avram. What Lavan tried to do to Yaakov. Sheparo lo gazar el al zacharim. Paro, he only decreed regarding the males. Velavan bikesh lakor esakol, and Lavan tried to destroy everyone. Shene amar arami aveda vi vayered mitzrayma, and this launches us into that section of arami aved avi, which is the brief synopsis of the events in Mitzrayim, which we will now expound upon for a good deal forward in Maggid. So what are we saying? We're saying you should really learn, should educate yourself, and discover just what Lavan tried to do to Yaakov. Paro only decreed against the males. Lavan tried to uproot everyone. And once again, let us ask some simple questions. Firstly, what is the meaning of Tseu Lamat? We translate Tseu Lamat, go out and learn. Where exactly are you meant to go out? Go out from where to where? And what does it mean, this phrase? It sounds like it's calling you to attention, as if to say, consider this, Tseu Lamat. But there are many things in the Haggadah, and there are many things throughout the year that require and deserve our attention. We do not preface them by saying Tseu Lamat. You could conceivably say Tseu Lamat about anything important, and there's many important things. But only here do we say Tseu Lamat. What do we mean by that? And what do we mean by bringing Lavan into the Seder at all? And who's even talking about him? He's got his own section when you get to the yearly Torah reading with Lavan, so you'll talk about him. In the meanwhile, I think we've got our hands full with the Jewish people in Egypt. So what's Lavan doing? Lavan is the most unexpected guest at the Seder table. Before you look around, he's in. And moreover, to what purpose do we quote him? With what in mind? It almost seems as if when you consider Lavan, Paro doesn't look that bad. Since when do we have a goal or a value of not making Paro look so bad? Paro should look as bad as he was. It's like we're saying, Paro, he did terrible things, but you know, it could have been worse. I mean, look at Lavan. I mean, that was he really, really tried to kill everyone. Relatively speaking, Paro is a 50% tzaddik. Since when is that one of the values of Seder night to make Paro not seem so bad? And what exactly do we mean when we say that Lavan tried to destroy everyone? Is that so? We know that he tried to kill Yaakov. But by the way, so did Esav. And moreover, Esav wanted to kill Yaakov when Yaakov didn't even have any children. Which means if he would have succeeded, chas v'chalila, that would be the end. Even as Lavan wanted to kill Yaakov, but Yaakov already had 12 children, they're Lavan's grandchildren, we don't assume he wanted to kill them also. So what exactly do we mean? It's also very interesting that the relationship of what we're saying and that section of Arami Oved Avi is reversed. This is the one time in Maggid where what you could call the energy flow of the Haggadah is reversed. What do we mean? Generally, from the time that we start to quote the section of Arami Oved Avi, the way things work is we take a word or a phrase that we quote from that section, and then we amplify it, and we elaborate with some proof text from Chumash Shemos or elsewhere. That is the flow. You start with a small quotation, a short quotation from that section, and then you elaborate. Here, there is no verse brought to elaborate on Arami Oved Avi. On the contrary, the words Aramea Vedavi, we don't cite anything to explain them. They are themselves brought in explanation of what we're saying. It's the one time where the Shene'emar takes you to that section. Lavan tried to destroy everyone. Shene'emar Arami Avedavi. The explained becomes the explainer. Everything is reversed. What is behind that? And finally, and important to note, of course, lest we think that the Haggadah is bringing Lavan into the Pesach story. It's the Torah that brings Lavan into the Pesach story. Because Lavan is mentioned in that pasuk, according to Chazal, Arami, Arami Oved Avi, Vayered Mitzrayma. So as a precursor, or somehow someone who's connected to the Pesach story, it's the Torah that links Lavan with the words. The first three words of that section are about Lavan, Arami Oved Avi. But this leads us to one of the most basic questions about this section. And it's a pshat question. The pasuk says, Arami Oved Avi Vayered Mitzrayma, which translate, according to Chazal, means Lavan the Arami, he wants to, or is trying to destroy my father Yaakov, and Yaakov went down to Mitzrayim. Arami Oved Avi Vayered Mitzrayma. There's something very problematic about putting those two phrases together. Because when you put them together, one after the other, it sounds like they're somehow connected to each other. But they're not. It seems that A led to B, which it did not. It is true that Lavan tried to kill Yaakov, and subsequently Yaakov went down to Mitzrayim. But those two things are not connected to each other. If you can envisage the child, the proverbial child who has no knowledge of anything, and he comes to Seder night and he hears this verse, he would be forgiven for concluding that Lavan tried to kill Yaakov and Yaakov ran away to Mitzrayim to get away from Lavan. I mean, that's what the pasuk says. Arami Aved Avi Vayered Mitzrayim. Lavan wants to kill Yaakov. Yaakov went down to Egypt. It sounds like it's because Lavan wants to kill him. Wherein the reality is, and we need to take a bit of a deep breath before we say exactly the sequence of events, but the way that it worked is Lavan tried to kill Yaakov and was unsuccessful, and Yaakov went back home, and Lavan went back home, and then a number of years passed, and then there was tensions with the brothers, with Yosef, and then Yosef was sold down to Mitzrayim, and then he became the viceroy, and then there was a famine in the land, and then it was discovered that he was alive, and then Vayered Mitzrayim. Yaakov went down to Egypt. If you take those two bookends of Arami Oved Avi and Vayered Mitzrayim and you put them together, so then that seems to be less than accurate as a causational portrayal of events. And that is a question that Rishonim and Achronim deal with on the Chumash. It's a basic pshat question. A question we could very easily not ask. So we are done with our questions for now. I think looking back, you know, four questions on Seder night seems rather mild in comparison, but let us see how a certain idea which the Netziv develops will be the thread that goes through all of these and see what comes out. And I say from the outset, I think it's one of the most challenging ideas of the Seder night, but the Netziv is no stranger to challenging ideas. And he starts with a kind of a bracing question. Seder night is about celebrating the Exodus. Asks the Netziv, pardon me, what's to celebrate? By which he means, you know, if someone else had put us into Egypt and then Hashem took us out, okay, that's to celebrate. But we shouldn't forget that it's Hashem himself who put us into Egypt. So when he takes us out, so that's good, but we're kind of back where we started. And he gives a mashal. He says, you know, if a doctor is walking by and happens to see someone lying there with a broken bone and fixes him up, so that person will be eternally grateful, and rightly so. But what if a person goes up to someone and himself breaks their bone, and then he also turns out to be a doctor and fixes it and it's good as new? It's not the same dynamic anymore. I don't think the person will be eternally grateful. It's the least he can do, and he shouldn't have done it in the first place. However, says the Netziv, and this, again, it's quite a startling question. But if we don't ask that question, then we may miss what Pesach is all about, or a significant part of what Pesach is all about. Because, says the Netziv, there is a third scenario. Namely, what if a person potentially has a much more serious problem than a broken bone? What if it's an internal organ that lo aleinu needs serious treatment? In a situation such as that, the treatment may involve breaking bones in order to get there. And that is part of the solution. In other words, says the Netziv, if the subtotal of the problem is a broken bone, then the problem begins when the bone is broken. But if there's a deeper problem, then set against that, the breaking of the bone is part of the solution. I've never heard, although I wouldn't be surprised, but I have never yet heard a person who had a doctor operate on him and break through some bones to get what he needed to get to pay him for the operation and to sue him for attacking him. It's all part of the treatment. What does this have to do with us? Says the Netziv, we need to appreciate. And Seder night is about the formation of the Jewish people. The oppression in Egypt and the exile in Egypt, it was a difficult situation. It was a problematic situation. But it was not the biggest problem that we had. The bigger problem that we had is Mitchila Ovdei Avodah Zarah Hayu Avoseinu. We were descended from and surrounded by and rooted in idol worship. And that is a much more severe problem. The first ones to rebel against that were the Avos, Avraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov. But the reality is the Jewish people, as generations progress, are not all on the level of Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov. And here, this brings us to a fascinating point to consider. We might be prone to look upon the exile in Egypt as a kind of a diversion from our path towards national success. As if to say, we started off in the land of Canaan, but then we got detoured to Egypt, and in the end, got taken out again. If only we'd stayed in Canaan, we would have had a much smoother path to success. That's what we might think. However, says the Netziv, the reality is just the opposite. Namely, had we not had the experiences that we had in Egypt, it could be that if we stayed in Canaan, we would have capitulated and disintegrated amidst the broader without any type of consolidating agent to give us fundamental resistance to idolatry and fundamental connection to Hashem. It could be that we would have disappeared within 3 or 4 generations. And this brings us to Golas Mitzrayim, to the exile of Egypt. And the truth is the Torah itself speaks about this, because the Torah refers in, this is in Parshas Vayeshanan, Devarim, Perek Dalet, Pasuk Kaf, refers to Egypt as Kor HaBarzel. It is the refining furnace, the smelting furnace. Kor HaBarzel, and what does a smelting furnace do? It refines the product. It rids it of impurities. What happened to us in Egypt? What happened to us during the difficult times in Egypt? 2 things happened. Firstly, as a nation of slaves, we were effectively reduced to almost non-existence. And in that respect, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu redeemed us, the Jewish people reattained a fundamental existence. It's almost like they'd been reduced to almost nothing. And then from there they came out. That's why it's called the birth of a nation. The birth is from almost nothing. And that's why as we attained our status as a nation, it was without any fundamental ties to the past, because all of that had been whittled away through the refining process in Egypt. And there is a second point, and it's a jarring point, and Rav Soloveitchik speaks about this, and he says that the Jewish people typically, they're drawn towards other ideologies because they see other nations who appear to succeed through those ideologies, and they aspire to be like them. Jewish people want to succeed, and these peoples appear to have the path towards success. And that's why, says Rav Soloveitchik, our exiles have typically brought us very close as an encounter to the highest among what those ideologies have to offer. And then we see ugliness and the brutality that they can engender. And it is a very traumatic experience of disillusionment. But by the time we're finished, if you ask the Jewish people, as if to say, had we stayed in Canaan, part of us would be saying, but if only we were in Egypt. The Egyptians know how to do it. They know how to succeed. If only we could be like Egyptians. And then they're brought together with the Egyptians, and they experience firsthand just how terrible people can be who subscribe to those ideologies that they craved. And now if you ask them, you still want to be an Egyptian? The answer is not in a million years. I'm happy with what I have. Happier. And therefore, when we talk about the story of Seder night, there are two stories. There's babushka within one within the other. As if to say, in the more immediate sense, what's the story of Seder night about? It starts with us being slaves, and it ends with us being free. I mean, that if the lens focuses in that immediate way. But there is a broader and more encompassing story, and within which the experiences in Mitzrayim take their place and enjoy a completely different context. And that is Mitchila Ovdei Avodah Zarah Hayu Avoseinu. The background to the story is, we had a much more serious problem than Golas Mitzrayim. It's called being rooted in Avodah Zarah. It could have destroyed us as a people. Mitchila Ovdei Avodah Zarah. Ve'achshav, and now, Kervonu Hamakom Lavodoso. And now Hashem brought us close to his service. When is now? To when does Achshav refer? It doesn't refer to standing at Har Sinai. The process of drawing us close to Hashem's service is the exile in Egypt. That's the refining furnace. That's the Kor HaBarzel. The Achshav. And now that we went down to Mitzrayim, and damage was done to us, but it's part of the solution against potentially much more critical damage. And that's why, says the Netziv, if you go back to the verses that we cite of Mitchila Ovdei Avodah Zarah, we cite two verses from Yehoshua. Why do we cite two verses from Yehoshua? Because we said two things, and we're looking to back them up. One verse each. The first thing we said is Mitchila Ovdei Avodah Zarah Hayu Avoseinu. Initially, our ancestors were idol worshippers, and to back up that idea, we quote the first verse: Be'ever Hanahar, etc. Vayavdu Elohim Acherim. And then, in order to provide a proof text for the second statement, Ve'achshav Kervanu Hamakom LaAvodaso, but now Hashem brought us close to his service, which is a reference to going down to Egypt and going through that refining experience. So to that we quote the second pasuk, which ends with the words, which leads up to the point where it concludes, V'yakov uvanav yardu Mitzrayim. Yaakov and the sons went down Mitzrayim, went down to Mitzrayim. That is the pasuk that backs up the Achshav Kevon Hamakom Lavodoso, through Yaakov Uvanov going down to Mitzrayim. And likewise, when we proceed in the next paragraph, you see how the Mefarshim, how carefully they're and exacting they are in terms of what is happening, what are we stating, and what are we proving. We say, Baruch Shem after Chosel Yisrael, we thank Hashem for keeping His promise. And then we quote the verse in Bris Ben HaBesorim, in its entirety, meaning not just the second half of the verse, which states, V'acharichen Yitzu B'chush Gadol. We thank Hashem, and this is the challenging idea of Seder night. We thank Hashem for keeping the entire promise, beginning from the beginning. Yadoa Teida, Ki Ger, we quote the whole Pasuk, because all of that is part of the process of taking us away from Avodah Zarah fundamentally, not behaviorally. That could still happen. There could be lapses. Even in Egypt there were lapses, ironically. But fundamentally, we thank Hashem for the whole promise. And by the way, and I haven't seen anyone who says this, but I think it's worth considering, how does Rav know that this is the story on Seder night to talk about our idolatrous roots, and then how does he know that's part of the story? Maybe leave that for another time, but just tell the story of Avodah Mayinu. I think the answer might be, I hope it's not an oversimplification, but the source for the mitzvah of telling the story on Seder night says, V'higadata levincha bayomahu lemor, tell your child, and what should you tell him? Ba'avur zeh asa Hashem li b'tzeisi mi'mitzray. For this, Hashem did for me when He took me from Mitzrayim. We note, the Pasuk doesn't say, tell your child what Hashem did. It says, tell your child why Hashem did it. I think that's the opening for Rav. That means you need to now expand on the story. You can't just say we were slaves and Hashem set us free, because you haven't addressed, you've addressed the Zeh. This is what Hashem did, but you haven't addressed the ba'avur zeh, but to what end? Why was it necessary? And what did it lead to? For that, you need to expand the story. I have a feeling that the words ba'avur zeh are a direct source for Rav's understanding of the way the story should be told. Until now, or thus far, we have spoken in theoretical terms. What might have happened to the Jewish people had they stayed in the land of Canaan? But the Haggadah doesn't leave it there. We get down to business. And we actually begin to discuss a real life case of a type of a person who represented that type of threat to us. And that is Lavan. And that is what Lavan is doing in the Pesach story. He represents the confrontation that we're talking about. You see, when you take a broad look at Lavan, and the way he acts with Yaakov, it's a very unusual situation. He detests Yaakov. In the end, he wants to kill him. But he keeps Yaakov close to him, and he has him marry his daughters. It seems to be the last word in masochism. The person he hates most, he has as his son-in-law twice over and working in his business for as long as he can. And it's not just because later on you would see the flock would increase. Initially, it's just a normal working relationship. If you can't stand him, why are you doing everything to keep him? Because what Lavan can't stand about Yaakov is that he's Yaakov. And therefore the perfect antidote for Yaakov's moral stance about things is Lavan. I mean, the longer he stays with Lavan, the more he'll see the light, the more he'll come to look at things in the way Lavan does. And that is what we mean when we say, Arami Oved Avi, Lavan Bikesh Lakor Es Hakol. He can't stand the fact that Yaakov exists as Yaakov. He's looking to uproot everything. That's not a reference to killing Yaakov. It's a reference to uprooting everything that Yaakov represents. And that's what comes, if you look, if you take a broad view and go through the whole parsha, that's the picture that emerges. Interestingly, it doesn't, unlike everything else in the Haggadah, this doesn't emerge from any isolated verse. You can't say love and try to kill everyone. Shene'emar. It's the whole parsha. And that's why we preface our discussion of Lavan by saying, Tseu lamad. Go out and learn. You've got to go out and learn the whole thing. It's not like everything else on Seder night, where if I say this word, I can explain it by that verse. And if I say this phrase, I can back it up by that other phrase in the pasuk. There is no one verse. You've got to look at the whole thing. Tseu lamad. And that's why we say. And the truth is, with this in mind, we can understand why we say, Arami oved avi vayered mitzrayma. Lavan tried to destroy Yaakov, and Yaakov went down to Egypt. And our question was, but there's no connection between those two things. I mean, one happened before the other, but so much in between. You say them as if they're connected. You say them as if A caused B. As if Lavan trying to kill Yaakov meant that Yaakov went down, led to Yaakov going down to Mitzrayim. Says the Netziv, it did. Not immediately, but ultimately. The type of danger represented by Lavan, and see how narrowly Yaakov escaped, and Yaakov's descendants are not Yaakov. So if you see Arami Aved Avi and you see the type of danger that Yaakov is facing unless something happens, that his children are facing unless something happens, something sooner or later was bound to happen, somewhere, somehow. And in the end, it was Vayered Mitzrayim. These two things really are connected with each other. So this is a very, I think it lies at the heart of Maggid. You can see how many paragraphs of Maggid are devoted to this idea. What is Lavan doing here? And why does the Arami Aved Avi start with Lavan? It all of this beckons us to have a deeper appreciation of why the whole Egypt experience was necessary. Not just Vayotzienu, but even Avodim Hayinu. And perhaps we'll conclude with a Hasidisha Vort. I think we've worked hard enough this evening, and this will, I think, be a good way of bringing things together. Many mefarshim, and of course, as soon as you consider it, you have to ask this question. There's two things that we eat. Should be three: Pesach, Matzah, and Maror. For us, there's Matzah and Maror. And in fact, we expound on each of these things. Why do we eat Pesach? Because we left so quickly. And why do we eat Maror? Because the Egyptians embittered our forefathers' lives. So we commemorate those two things. But amazingly, we commemorate them in reverse historical order. I would have thought, especially following the concept of start with a negative and end with a positive, so start with the Maror, which is the negative, Vayimaru es Hayim, and then move to the positive, Matzah, which is when we left. It's a very interesting shaila. Seems to be quite difficult. We remember first things last. So why do we commemorate the earlier event later on? Why do we eat Maror after Matzah? And the Bnei Yisachar, the great Reb Tzvi Elimelech Shapira of Dinov, one of the ancestors of the Munkacher dynasty. The Bnei Yisachar says, eating Maror before Matzah and eating Maror after Matzah is not the same. If you eat Maror before Matzah, so you are localizing and containing the bitter experiences of Maror just within the framework of things were bitter and then they got better. We had Maror and then we had Matzah, but you have no appreciation of what the Maror did. And by the way, I think it's fair to say that the Jewish people at the time when they were undergoing these experiences did not particularly appreciate what they were doing, what the effect it was having on them. So to eat Maror before Matzah is to constrain the message of Maror and ultimately a disservice of the entire Egypt experience. And that's why we say no. First eat your matzah. First leave Egypt. Because when you do, and you're finally able to get a look at yourself as to what you look up like when you left Mitzrayim, now think back. Remember the Maror. Because when you're in a place that you can appreciate what you gained through the Kor HaBarzel, when the Jewish people stood at Har Sinai as a nation, they stood in a way that they could not have stood without the purifying furnace of Mitzrayim. And therefore, first leave, then we'll talk about Maror. First get out and celebrate your connection with Hashem that you did. And once you have that connection, the way that you look back at Maror itself will be completely different. And thus we have first Pesach and Matzah, or in our time, first Matzah, and then Maror. Very, very compelling idea. And again, it takes it for things from the realm of discussion to the realm of the Seuda itself. And this, I think, is a fuller picture. And for us who are looking to get a deeper insight into the Haggadah, and it's right in front of us in the Haggadah, certainly I think there is much to contemplate. And the more we appreciate about what we attained in Mitzrayim, and the more that we celebrate that connection, the more we can have hope to further strengthen and rejuvenate that connection. And that is something that will lead the concept of redemption to be not only something that we remember that happened, but something that we can anticipate to happen. Hashem took us out of Mitzrayim for a reason, and the redemption is not over. The connection was achieved fundamentally, but not totally. But the more we go back and celebrate and reinvigorate it on the fundamental level, the more we can hope to see its full realization on the ultimate level, with the final redemption which should come b'mehirah b'yamein. I wish you all chag kasher v'sameach and all the very best. We will meet again in Mitzvah Hashem in 2 weeks' time.